Hey everyone, just a note that the views expressed on the Holy Schism do not reflect the views of St. Mary's Parish in Kitchener, C3KW, the C3 movement, or our places of employment. This is really just Andrew and Sam having a good time, and we hope that you do too.
Welcome back to Holy Schism. My name is Sam, and I'm a Protestant.
I'm Andrew, and I am still a Catholic.
Which one of us do you think is more likely to convert? Here, bear in mind that I'm married.
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, it's hard to convert to like a different tradition when you're married. Oh. You have to like convince
hard but not impossible.
Yeah,
you've ever heard of Scott Hahn?
Yes, and I've heard of Father what was that other guy, John Henry Newman, Cardinal John Henry Newman.
Yeah,
I've heard of all of them, Andrew.
There you go. Yeah, we're back. And okay, sorry, which one of us would be easier to convert? I don't know, that's tough. You said you're married, so that would pull you in one direction. Also, your in-laws are pretty committed Protestants.
And my parents, to an extent, like they don't, okay, in fairness, my parents, like they're not tied to any denomination really, but like my dad really loves Martin Luther.
Oh, that's just a funny sentence.
I think I would disappoint a lot of people.
That's like a funny Twitter bio. My dad really loves Martin Luther.
Yeah.
I think it would be a big, big shock if I converted,
you are Protestant, like probably the most devout Catholic I know. Well, like that's my age that I know. I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure there's people that are better Catholics than you, but
not in my Catholic life. But I see what you're saying. I do work for a Catholic church, and I have a lot of, so hence the Holy Schism.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I have received a fair bit of a few comments from friends that, they do really appreciate like the ecumenical dialogue. I don't know of that many other podcasts that like, and I don't know, do this like that, have this kind of niche where it's,
I hope we're doing something that's kind of unique and helpful, because like we've been friends for a decade now.
Yeah.
This year it'll be a decade that we've been friends.
That's awesome.
And I think at least that we've only become better Christians over that decade.
Yes, certainly.
And so we become better Christians and we become better friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of the goal, right? Is at least to witness to that possibility that, the Christians of different denominations can be friends.
Right? Yeah. I mean, if it's not obvious, I'm like pretty confident Andrew and I are going to be sharing eternity together. I'm like, I don't know how confident Andrew is, but I'm pretty confident in that.
I'm pretty confident too. And
provided I convert to Catholicism.
On a super side note, this is not what we were going to talk about in this episode, but I just finished this research project for the course that I just finished up. Really,
what's your degree? Tell the audience.
I'm working on a master's. It's part time, so it's going to take me a little while to finish it. But it's called a Master of Catholic Thought. So through St. Jerome's University, where Sam and I did our, where we lived in residence, and I guess we were both co-registered, right?
No, I wasn't, but yeah, I do have the grad ring.
You do. We both do. So anyway, our alma mater, I've gone back and I'm working on this Master of Catholic Thought. It's a theology degree. So this course that, I'm finishing up, I did a research project on the Taizé community in France. I don't know if you're familiar with Taizé at all.
No.
A lot of their music has become really popular, like even in our hymnals, like a lot of even Lutheran and Catholic hymnals will have these really short, repetitive hymns that are meditative. So you just repeat them over and over and over again. One famous one, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Mm, okay.
Jesus,
I know that.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
So that all comes out of this community in France. And, long story short, founded in World War II, 1943, they've been going for about, I think 1940 or 43. Anyway, they're radically ecumenical. So they've got people from all different denominations coming together in this common life of prayer. And they're actually like a community of brothers. So they have professed members who have taken, they wouldn't say vows, they say commitments. That's a whole other thing. But they're very in their history, very friendly and comfortable with the popes, Catholic popes, but many of them are coming from Protestant denominations. Mm. The Episcopalian, the Anglican Communion, they have all of these kind of influences on their community. And anyway, so that's just on my mind right now as we do this, the Holy Schism, which is meant to be kind of in that vein of ecumenical activity.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, if I have an agenda probably with all this, it's like, I don't think this is going to happen in my lifetime necessarily, but I do think it is Christ's ultimate desire that the church is reunited. And I think right now it looks impossible, but I don't think it is. You know, like obviously we got the three big branches, Orthodoxy, Catholicism, and Protestantism. And there's a lot of seemingly irreconcilable differences, but, I don't know. Nothing's impossible with the Lord. I mean, there's already been like, there's been some like long, like centuries, millennia old controversies that have been like fairly recently resolved. Like, I don't know if you know about this, but like, you know about like the Coptic Orthodox Church or the Oriental Orthodox? Yeah. Like, so they're like, they actually are not, I don't think they were in communion even with the Eastern Orthodox Church because they had a different Christological like position dating back to like the 4th century. And like fairly recently, both churches were like, yeah, like the difference here is like semantic. It's not like that substantive, and it shouldn't really prevent us from being like brothers in Christ.
It's incredible.
So like, and I think just like that's maybe one benefit of the information age too, where like podcasts can be disseminated and ideas can be disseminated more quickly, is like, I don't know, people are still going to fall into their camps, and there's a lot of polarization also as a result of this where people get very siloed. But like, I also think this information is more accessible now in a way that it wasn't before. And maybe the truth will shake out and become just more obvious.
Well, I see even in my lifetime, I see like Greek, Ukrainian Orthodox that I've come in contact with that who are in communion with Rome. And then again, in my lifetime, Pope Benedict's outreach to Anglicans and the creation of Anglican ordinariates, where you have Anglican rites that are again in communion with Rome. And so there's these flavors of the kind of the culture and the prayer and the tradition of East as well as, you know, Anglican that are completely, I think I can accurately say, completely in line with the Catholic Church but offer these different, I like the term flavors of Catholicism, flavors of Christianity.
Sure.
Not to trivialize the differences between us, but at least to recognize the possibility of union. And then the other thing maybe I'll just say on this point is this, I really do think it starts with encountering people, you know, like I say, we've been friends for a decade. If we start by getting to know friends and family members, and understanding their experience of faith and their experience of the church, it can at least open up the possibility that we can move closer together, that we can actually like agree on certain things and then focus on that and then contrast the areas where we don't agree, right?
Yeah. Like some bad ideas are going to have to die ultimately for true unity to really happen. And I hopefully time and the Holy Spirit reveals what those things are. But I don't know, like, yeah, I agree. I think we should, the best thing to do is focus on the areas where you do agree. And
we also need to have fun with it.
Yeah, we do. Speaking of having fun, follow our Instagram account at Holy Schism, because we are also entering the meme game, the Christian meme game.
What is the handle, the actual handle?
It's at Holy Schism. Yeah.
At Holy Schism. Yeah. That wasn't taken already?
No. We picked a really good name for this podcast because like I've been able to register it on every platform.
That's
it's
incredible.
Not taken. Yeah.
Man, when we get a website going, we're just going to...
Oh, yeah, we should make a website, shouldn't we? At very least, we should make a Tumblr.
Tumblr.
I don't know if people still use that. Some people do use that for their
websites.
We
should have a MySpace. A MySpace. And a we should have a SoundCloud.
The meme page has been a lot of fun, though. I've been doing a deep dive into like Christian social media. I largely don't really like social media. Like I haven't posted on anything on my personal Instagram account in like 2 years, because I've found it to be so like self-aggrandizing and self-promotion. It's just
it's very draining.
It's just vanity. And like I feel vain posting a picture of myself and watching the likes roll in. But now like I'm having fun with it again because I'm making memes and like I see like videos and I'm like, oh, I can make a meme out of that. And like it is like fulfilling a creative itch that I've had, I think. And Andrew's been giving me some ideas as well. And
you're much better at actually making them
that's just
come to life.
It's just because I know how to use Photoshop and Premiere. That too. But
you also know, like, we're both millennials, right? So
we're not quite as down with the
Zoomers. That's right.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know. I would say like spicy memes. I don't even know if Gen Z says that.
Yeah. I don't think they do. No, I think that's a little dated.
I think that's a little dated already. But we were definitely producing some spicy memes recently.
Yeah, there's some. I'm sitting on a couple that, like, I'm scared to post them. Because I think I might lose some followers if I post them. And they're like, I don't know if my conscience would appreciate it either. But I think they're really funny. But we'll see. There's one that I have, like, if I post it, I'm going to post it on Reformation Day. Because it's like...
Father Bob Bedard said, sorry, I cut you off there.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Father Bob Bedard said, he was from Ottawa, and anyway, he said, we should take the Lord very seriously, but we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously.
That's true.
I think that's exactly what we're trying to do with, you know, having fun on Instagram.
I don't want to make fun of anything to do with the Lord, but I want to make fun of people. You know what I mean? And myself to an extent. And myself.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've done a good job of making fun of everybody. Like, I think if someone were to stumble on our account, they would have no idea what our theological angle is. And that's kind of the way I want it to be. Like, I people say they make fun of everybody. And I, you know, obviously there are probably some things that I have neglected to make fun of because I don't see the humor in them.
Yeah.
But everything that I think is like a little bit silly or like funny or like worth digging into a little bit, nothing's really off the table for me.
We're not defending a thesis with this podcast. We are more just commenting on things that we've experienced. And then we're trying to point out the absurd things that we see happening.
I think that's definitely the heart of it. Cause like, I would rather not get mad at things. I'd rather laugh at them. There's so much to like be upset about or so many things to like be offended over. And I like, it's exhausting just being angry all the time. Like, why not just like have a laugh at the expense of it? I think that's a better, so that's a more sane way to live life, in my opinion. But you know, Instagram has been fun. So there's a couple of genres of posts that have really fascinated me. There, one is the Christian thirst trap. Have you seen these? It'll be like, it's particularly on TikTok, but you see it on Instagram too, where it's like these like beautiful 19, 20 year old boys and they're like doing their smolder pose, but they post like some like really like nice spiritual insight.
It's
just text, but it's a thirst trap.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is such a weird juxtaposition.
Right.
It's like what do you think you're doing here?
Yeah.
You know, I think you know what you're doing. I think you're looking for a 20 year old Christian Insta girl to hit you up in your DMs. But
it's funny too, because I think like, not only does, when you post a quote from scripture or something like that, it has this weird double effect. Not only does it's like, hinting at sort of a sensitive side, but it's also hinting at a bit of an intellectual side, because it's I'm familiar with the Bible a little bit, right?
It's all fake.
So it's like, I'm a good boy, really, even though I'm a bit of a bad boy.
It's just advertising yourself.
Do you ever follow Church Chad?
I think I've seen some of those posts. Guys,
they're hilarious. They do all this, but they often do little short videos, TikTok and things where it's like, you know, the guy at a Christian college or whatever, right, on the first day, and he's already shopping for a wife, you know,
right?
he's going, I feel like the Holy Spirit is just asked me to take you out on a date this week, you know, whatever.
Oh yeah, God told me I'm gonna marry you. Right. Is that a thing at like Catholic colleges? Like, it wouldn't be like, obviously. Okay, I guess obviously you
mostly morally depraved, so I don't know.
Well, that's true. We did go to a Catholic college, but no, I guess it's not the same thing, because a lot of our Bible colleges are like also like seminaries. It's like people that want to become pastors. And then if you're doing that in a Catholic church, you're not going to get married in the first place. So,
but I do think there, like, there are maybe not at colleges, but there are different, like the, CCO, right, in Canada, Catholic Christian Outreach is a big campus ministry organization, right? So there'll be missionaries that go on there, and the joke was always that CCO stands for Catholic Couples Outreach, right? So people go on, they do a year with CCO,
bridal college,
they find their spouse, right? Which, you know, is okay, I suppose, but at the same time, it is kind of funny to suggest that, you know, it's like the Lord is calling me to get engaged to this person I met last week. You know, it's like, I don't know. That's
what if the Lord, giving you the gift of celibacy?
Bingo. That's the whole, that's what makes discernment tough. But we're having fun with it. I don't know. How are we doing? Let's take a little break here. We'll get a little serious in a second.
Sure.
Can the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a banner overweighted in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
All right, Andrew, what's going on in the Catholic world?
We're back. Something I just want to bring up is that the Archdiocese of Toronto, the largest English-speaking diocese in Canada, has a new archbishop. And he was just installed a couple weeks prior to this taping.
What's his deal? What's his bit?
Couple things. I think it's pretty notable. I think we should be paying attention. So Francis Leo... Not Pope Francis, but Francis, who normally goes by Frank.
Hey, Frank Leo.
Frank Leo is the son of Italian immigrants to Montreal. And so prior to this, he was an auxiliary bishop in Montreal. And as far as bishops go, he's pretty young. I believe he's 51 years old.
Oh, he looked younger than that in the clip we just watched.
Yeah, he's got kind of a youthful kind of energy to him. And he is coming again to Toronto following the retirement. So in the church, we typically have mandatory retirement at 75, right? So for pastors, bishops, cardinals, 75 is the age when they retire. So Cardinal Collins reached that age. He was the Archbishop of
Toronto. And then they put him out to pasture, took him out to a farm in the country.
It's actually funny. Like some, you know, lead quite a quiet life. Some are still fairly active. I know a pastor who's in Kitchener who's coming up on retirement this year, and he's indicated that he would like to stay as an associate pastor for his parish. But it's against the rules of the church for a 75-year-old to lead a parish. And there's wisdom in that. We could talk about that. But the contrast is there, right? Like, Cardinal Collins has led the Archdiocese for a number of years. He's come up on this age limit, and now they're bringing in a considerably younger man to lead the Archdiocese. And I shared this clip with you from the first Mass where they installed Archbishop Leo, and I thought it was a beautiful Mass for a number of reasons. One, just to set the setting, you know, priests from all over the diocese come as many as can come to celebrate and to acknowledge a new archbishop, right? Yeah. Also, bishops from across Canada come, you know, and in the tradition, as I watched the mass, the what we call the apostolic nuncio, so that's the Pope's representative in a particular country. So we have the apostolic nuncio for Canada.
Yeah,
he will read out. So he will actually open the mass. So he will be the presider for the mass, right?
Right.
And so he'll open it up. There's a beautiful kind of entrance hymn, and they'll process in, and the apostolic nuncio will be presiding. He's a bishop, and then at a certain point, he'll read the letter from Pope Francis appointing Frank Leo as archbishop, and he'll read it, and it'll be read to the... Actually, sorry, I think they had another priest read it, but it'll be read, and then it will be presented to the new archbishop, and then the archbishop will, like, actually hold the letter and present it to the congregation.
Ah, okay.
And then the apostolic nuncio will vacate the chair,
yeah,
the seat, to the new archbishop, who then becomes the presider for the rest of the mass.
Okay, yeah.
So there's sort of this symbolic, you know, ritual of, like, okay, now he's being installed, right, as the archbishop.
Okay, that's cool.
Which is kind of neat. And at the same time, Cardinal Collins, who is the old archbishop, is there present and is recognized.
And I also just want to, like, just say this for our listeners too, like, you know, we're used to, like, if you're Protestant, if you're like me, if you're a Protestant, you're used to, like, go to the church and there's not really much ceremony to our services. It's just like, okay, we're doing the worship. All right. Now the pastor is getting up to speak. But, like, this idea of, like, a presider or a president, this is, like, this goes back a long time to, like, I mean, Justin Martyr writes about it in the year 150 AD of, like, one who is presiding over this mass, this communion service. So like, it's just, it's a bit more formal, I guess, in the Catholic Church. I wanted to ask, I don't think I've understood fully, like, how an archbishop gets selected or appointed. Like, what is that process like?
I listened to a podcast between, Bishop Scott McKegg, whom I've met before and my brother has met because he's a Companion of the Cross, and he is the bishop for the Military Ordinariate of Canada. So all of the military chaplains who serve in the armed forces report to this bishop, which is kind of a cool ministry to be a part of.
That's neat.
He did a podcast with Matt Fratt on Pints with Aquinas talking about that. And it's evolved over time, right? But it is fairly secretive for obvious reasons, you know, like, you don't want to create a culture of clericalism in the sense of ladder climbing, of jockeying for positions in the church.
Yeah.
Basically what happens is that, you know, different names get floated to, again, the nuncio. The nuncio is the Pope's representative in a particular country or a particular region of the world. And my understanding is that, you know, different priests will be talked about, right? And then they may be approached, again, for confidentiality reasons, right? Like you don't... So suppose somebody declines the appointment of bishop. There are many priests who have declined the appointment of bishop. That, in fact, my understanding is that's more and more common. It's a really demanding role.
Right.
There's a number of reasons for that, but they want to keep it confidential. So it does become, again, this idea of scandal of, you know, there's basically a kind of a vetting. It sounds sort of the way the sausage is made. It sounds, very practical, but it is, you know, there are conversations with people who have worked with the particular pastor, who are family members, who are friends of this person, you know, is this a good candidate for bishop?
Reference check and all that. Basically. Sounds like a job interview.
Yeah, kind of. Essentially, right? Yeah. And then there's a formal kind of, a formal kind of invitation by the nuncio on behalf of the Holy Father, the Pope, to accept the appointment as bishop. Now, in this case, my understanding is Frank Leo was a bishop already. I believe he was the auxiliary of Montreal. I'm fairly certain of that. Okay. And so it's appointment as an archbishop. The archdioceses are essentially just the large kind of important dioceses.
Yeah.
Toronto, Montreal, others. They might have auxiliary bishops with them, right? Because there's such a large area.
Yeah.
But the archbishop just be one would be bishop. The head, right?
Yeah.
So that has happened. What's also neat about the installation mass is like there are tons of just important people present. As far as I understand, like several members of parliament were present at this mass.
Oh, cool.
The police chief of Toronto was present. Representatives from a number of faith traditions. I'm pretty positive Jewish, Sikh, Muslim, Anglican. There's probably a few others I'm missing. Like we're all present
bunch of
at
heretics.
This mass, right? what was obvious here was that St. Michael's Cathedral in Toronto hosted a very formal, but like the sense when you watch the video, you see it all on YouTube. It was a pretty joyful celebration of this new archbishop. And I just thought he gave a very lengthy sermon, a very lengthy homily. Understandably, he acknowledged the people who were present. He acknowledged his family. He acknowledged the outgoing Archbishop Cardinal Collins. You know, there was a lot of kind of formalities that he did. But then he preached, right? And the one clip that I want to share, we'll share with the listeners, was all about he was basically addressing young people in the crowd and young people in the archdiocese.
Our parish was staffed by many dedicated pastors of souls, dynamic missionaries. I remember especially the energy, the creativity, and the generosity of our pastor back then, Father Hermenegildo Crespi. Another loving priest was Father Luigi Testa, God rest his soul. One day, when we were about to begin Mass, at the sacristy door, he stopped me and he said to me, "I heard that you went to the seminary and to become a priest. This is very good, and I am proud of you. There's nothing more beautiful than to give your youth to the Lord." These words have remained deep inside of me and have never left my heart. In Italian, I can still hear him say, "Non c'è niente più bello che dare la tua gioventù al Signore." So I appeal to the young people here this morning and throughout the archdiocese. Do not be afraid of the world. Do not be afraid to give your life in service to others. Do not be afraid to dream big dreams, to want to transform the world. Do not be afraid to commit to Jesus and to his gospel. Do not be afraid to love the church and to be an integral part of her witnessing and to live a life of heroic virtue. Do not be afraid to give your youth to the Lord. Stay close to your parish church and to the movements and associations in the church. Get involved in the realities of school, of neighborhood, and social needs. Share your talents. Discover your giftedness. Ask the Lord to reveal to you his will for your life, your authentic vocation. Reach out to others. Let Jesus into your heart and allow Mother Mary to take you by the hand.
So, I don't know, when you first hear that bit, what strikes you? I'm curious.
Yeah, he seems very likable. Like he has a real charisma to him, but it's like a very soft kind of charisma. It reminds me a bit of Pope Francis.
Oh, interesting.
The demeanor of him. And like, to be fair, I don't think I've ever watched a video of Pope Francis speaking in English. So I think something is probably lost in translation yeah, of course. Totally. And I don't I have to read subtitles to understand what is being said, but like, there's just like a calmness to his voice and like a sensitivity to it. And like, some oratory skills are learned and projected, and you don't can't know a person truly through that alone. But, I like his presence. I like totally. The way he talks, and I could listen to him talk for a long time. I think
he's very Catholic in the sense that he's not charismatic in the way, a Southern Baptist or a Pentecostal preacher might be.
Right. Yeah.
It's so interesting. Like the accent and the lilt in his voice, right?
Oh yeah. I enjoyed that. Maybe that's what it was.
It's just Italian Montrealer. Right.
You got to bring me a calzone.
Yeah.
that was maybe a little more New York, but.
No, it's getting there. Everyone needs to know that the love of Jesus.
Yeah, he was very Italian. Like, it was surprising given that he was born and raised in Canada.
It's kind of wild, you know?
It was very Italian.
So, on like the content, so when he addresses young people in particular, he's echoing John Paul II. And I think that's deliberate. So John Paul is in, I hope I'm getting my dates right, 78 elected Pope. And in his first address at his installation, he says, do not be afraid or be not afraid. And that's like a recurring theme. And like, you can find t-shirts and banners and posters and stuff of John Paul II with be not afraid as one of his taglines. Particular to young people. And so when he's saying like, you know, do not be afraid of the world, do not be afraid to get involved in your church, do not be afraid to like that, that's definitely an echo. And I think like considering that John Paul II was like, that was in the end of the 70s into the 80s. I think so many things are cyclical. There's something about totally, like we're here in 2023. There's probably real value in a younger leader of the church driving that message home.
Young Pope.
You know?
Yeah.
That's okay. You've already preempted my next point.
Well, I mean, it's the Italian name. It's too good not to.
Like, I don't want to go too far out on a limb here, but the popes have predominantly been European. Pope Francis was the first South American pope. But his parents were Italian, so he's the son of Italian immigrants to Argentina. So, you know, the apple doesn't fall
from the tree.
Too far from the Roman tree. But I am going to call it right here on Holy Schism. I think Frank Leo will be made a cardinal, which means
that's the next step up, basically.
Exactly, which means he will be one of the electors for the next Pope for the Pope. He'll be in the conclave, and it also makes him a leading candidate. Would make him a leading candidate for Pope. If he's not the next Pope, I doubt he would be the next Pope after Pope Francis. But I'm gonna call it right here. I think he could be Pope one day.
So maybe in like 15-20 years, kind of thing.
That would make him the first Canadian, first North American Pope.
Yeah.
Is that like too crazy an idea?
I mean, I think you're going to be predisposed to bias because, you know, you see an exceptional individual out of your own country that's going to bias you somewhat. But I don't think it's that crazy. I mean, like, he looks like he's I've just seen a clip of him, but he looks like he has a lot of the qualities that you might look for in a pope, at least. I can see it. But I mean, I also don't know who the other candidates might be. I don't know how, like, I'm sure he's going to stack up with like the best and brightest of the other nations of the world too. So
it's true.
I don't know.
The funny thing is like, so technically the Pope, does not need to be a bishop or a cardinal. Don't even believe they need to be a priest. Again, for all intents and purposes, the modern papacy, this is how it's developed. We have the conclave in which the cardinal bishops gather in the Sistine Chapel and they elect one of their own to become the Pope. But so that what's interesting when you kind of like delve into, especially online, all the talk about is this term, papabile, right? Which means like, popable, right?
Okay,
like,
okay.
So they'll talk right. about people who could potentially be the Pope, right?
Potential, right?
And maybe we'll do, we could do a whole episode on just like if, talking about this, but
if you're not a priest, then like what? Because I guess in my Protestant mind, I think of it as like, first you're a priest, then you're a bishop, then you're an archbishop, then you're a cardinal, then you're a pope. Like, what other path is there?
My understanding is, I'm just going to like fact check myself.
Like a monk?
Real quick.
Could a monk be pope? Like, in theory, they could, right? It's a holy order. A nun could not be pope.
Yeah. The pope, real quick from Google, I'm like pretty positive. Yeah, any baptized male can be elected pope.
Wait, so like technically. A married person could be pope?
The pope does not need to be a cardinal, elector, or indeed a cardinal. Since the pope is the bishop of Rome, only those who can be ordained a bishop can be elected, which means that any male baptized Catholic is eligible.
But like you have still to be celibate to be a bishop.
The last pope who was not a priest when elected was Leo the X. From he was served from 1513 to 15.
Hey, that was the Reformation pope. That was the guy that failed to keep the church together when Martin Luther.
There you go. Maybe who don't repeat that error?
Yeah.
No.
Who knows what could happen?
He had to be ordained before taking office, so I do think you need to be. My understanding is you have to be ordained before becoming pope, but not to be elected.
Wow. Okay, so I still assume you have to be
again,
single.
For all intents and purposes,
yeah.
The Pope will be one of the cardinals in the conclave.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so already like people, of course, because of Pope Francis's health and different things, people are already talking about like who could be the next Pope, right? And who could be the Pope even after that, right? Because you consider that a lot of these cardinals are already into their 60s and 70s. When they're there, right? And that's just part of the nature of how this has worked
you gain more wisdom as you get older.
Yeah. And so, you know, popes don't tend to serve for super long, but here we have the Archbishop of Toronto is 51, you know, supposing he is made a cardinal in the next few years. You know, there's a real path in which he could become, you know, before age 60 or shortly after age 60. The Pope and serve for a number of years, for even a few decades, right?
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't. What's like the average age that someone becomes like a priest at in the Catholic Church? I mean, I guess it could be anything, but like, you know, if
someone, anything like yeah. most right at least in the modern church. You know, the path to priesthood is fairly academic. So there's usually at least, I would say, 6 or 7 years to study to become a priest. So, I mean, you do have young men out of high school, 17, 18, who go right into formation and they're maybe 23, 24, I would say, would be the youngest age for a priest.
Wow. Right. That's pretty young, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas us Protestants, we'll ordain anybody. We'll ordain children.
Actually, young do you think they're? You know, how long do you think a pastor is?
Well, I mean, so my pastor actually, like, he became
he was probably around that age, right?
Yeah, no, he became the lead pastor of a church, I think, when he was 24, which is wild. I couldn't imagine being a lead pastor at my age. I'm 28.
Some people are cut out for it.
Like, you know, those Enneagram 8s, you know, they're cut out for it.
And that's why I would think that it is odd to have a bishop, you know, I don't want to go out on a limb and say it's unheard of to have a bishop like under the age of 40, but like, you know, to have a bishop under the age of 45 is odd. And so then to have like one of the most important dioceses in not only in Canada, like Toronto. When you think about it, Toronto is one of the cities, you know, in league with London, New York, Washington, you know, in terms of its size and importance.
Yeah.
You know, so have a 51-year-old being the Archbishop of Toronto. I don't know. I think it's pretty
normally,
important.
Yeah. Would they normally be in their like 60s, 70s?
I would say so. Role? Yeah. Okay. I don't know all of the past predecessors, but, you know, it is a pretty big
responsibility. Well, yeah. I mean, I was looking at some of those fellas up on the stage with him there. Yeah. That's probably not the right term.
A lot of white hair.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say most of them looked older than him.
Totally. Like this definitely feels like a generational shift that's happening. And I don't want to overstate it, but something about it just feels like in the Canadian Catholic Church, something might be shifting. Maybe something else I was thinking about was I was at a presentation at St. Jerome's, and we had a little kind of meet and greet with the presenter and the president of St. Jerome's, and don't think I'm telling tales outside of school, was commenting on Frank Leo's appointment. It was new that it had been announced. He hadn't been installed yet, but he was just like, people are noticing, I guess is what I'm saying. People are noticing that, yeah, this younger man is leading the Archdiocese of Toronto. He's bringing a bit of breath of fresh air. At the same time, his sermon, like if you watch the entirety of it, it's hard to pigeonhole it as liberal or conservative, as, you know, new agey. He seems
transcends it all.
Yeah. Bit. Yeah. There's something about it that is very orthodox. And yet, like he says to the young people, do not be afraid. There's a boldness to it that,
yeah. It's very down to earth.
Yeah. In a sense.
Yeah.
So he's invoking, on the one hand, he's invoking the memory of a John Paul II, but perhaps for the age of a Pope Francis, which is again, why I think I think he's going to play an important role in the church going forward. There's no doubt. I pray for him. I pray for the success of his ministry. And if I was a betting man, I would put a dollar or two on Frank Leo.
Can we bet like right now? I would like to put a bet on him, that as well. If there's like a betting line for like,
yeah,
the Pope in, you know,
I'm sure there must
couple
be.
Of decades.
Let's
find that. I think
post in the comments below.
Yeah, if you find that, let us know.
Because there's a bunch. Like, so one of the main successors, I don't know, I would go down this rabbit hole a little bit with you if you want.
Yeah, totally.
One of the main talked about names is Cardinal Tagle, who's of the Philippines. And so he's an appointee of Pope Francis. Pope Francis made him a cardinal. And he's a very charismatic, very joy-filled cardinal, and a real personality, you know. And many have talked about him as representative of Pope Francis's desire to reach out to areas of the world that haven't been represented in the church, South America, Africa, and Asia, in particular.
So I assume he is ethnically Filipino.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be the first European descended Pope, basically, right?
Yeah. The only qualifier, I guess, I'm not sure about the early church and its relationship to Africa.
Yeah, that's fair. Right? That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure, in the last thousand years. Yeah. Yeah. Cause certainly the way they talk about, you know, Pope Francis being non-European in that sense of being from South America.
Yeah.
Is about our recent history. You know, even the idea of like non-Italian at a certain point was a big deal, you know, and then you have John Paul II, who's from Poland, right? And that changed so much, right? Like his fight against communism throughout the 80s and into the 90s was a big deal, because he came from a country where priests had to hide in basements, you know, like,
they love him in Poland.
Totally, totally.
Like, when I was there, I was just struck by like how much they love John Paul II.
And this theme of like, be not afraid was a big deal, you know, like he worked to restore hope to Christian communities, who were really under the threat of, like I say, the communist spread. So anyway, Cardinal Tagle is one. Interestingly, like Cardinal Robert Seurat, a much more conservative cardinal, and I don't know his age, so I have to check. It might be that he's becoming too old, but he's an African bishop who's much more of the right, more conservative, more traditionalist.
Sure.
But a name that keeps being talked about. The Canadian that people really talked about, although I think he'll be too old, is Cardinal Ouellette from Marc Ouellette from Quebec. He's been a big player in Vatican politics, if you will. He's just had a lot of roles in the Vatican. And the rumors were that even in the past conclave that elected Pope Francis in 2013, Cardinal Ouellette was somebody that people voted for. And he's Quebecois, you know, which again, it's hard to overstate as well as understate what a difference it makes where the Pope comes from, you know?
Yeah. It totally shapes their perspective on the world.
Totally. And I think like it shapes the perspectives of Christians in their home country, in their home region, you know?
Yeah.
I really think for...
Yeah, that would actually be... I wonder how powerful that would be for Canadian Catholics, especially like I think of like lapsed Catholics or Christmas and Easter Catholics. Would a Pope from our country becoming... like, would that make a difference in their faith?
I wonder. I can't help but think, like, imagine the first... visit, the homecoming of sorts,
right,
of a Frank Leo, you know, to Toronto to host a public mass where you could feasibly have like a million people show up to, you know.
Yeah, like, the only other way you get that is if the Leafs win the cup. Never gonna happen. I think we need Frank to bring the city together.
Funny, in that homily, he talks about, yeah, of course, he's a huge Habs fan, right? So,
oh, good for him. Yeah, I like him already.
He said right away, he said, we have to address the elephant in the room, my beloved Habs and your beloved Leafs.
That's hilarious. That's
funny, right?
That's like, good.
Yeah. So anyway, I think we should keep our eye on this. I think we should really... pray for the success of his ministry in Toronto, which is a tough place to be a Christian leader.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's an ever-changing city, but also for the judgment, the wisdom of Pope Francis in appointing this man to be a successor of the apostles, which I believe Frank Leo is. And, you know, for his... clearly his outreach and his challenge to you and me, to young people, to be bold, be unafraid of the Christian community, the Christian way of life, you know, to witness to that.
Yeah. I don't know if it's just me changing or if it's the media I'm consuming that's changing or what it is. I do feel like people have been more bold lately, or just like less afraid of...
That's interesting. Yeah. Tell me more about that.
I just think people aren't afraid to like be ridiculed by, I don't know, for better, lack of a better term, the world. You know what I mean? I don't like the culture warrior mentality, the like Turning Point USA kind of thing where... you know, it's us against them and we're going to fight this culture war. We're going to be big, brash and bold. But like, I think there is more, I'm seeing more of a boldness, especially in Gen Z that doesn't care quite as much as our, like the millennial generation about being politically correct. as much as Gen Z is also like way more, they're way more secularized, I guess, to an extent, but they're also just like way more brash and honest in some ways. And so the Christians among Gen Z, I think, seem a little less timid. And again, maybe this is just me spending my time among the Zoomer memers on Instagram lately, but I don't know. I think I'm seeing coming out of COVID, coming out of, you know, I think a lot of people became very disillusioned in a lot of things during COVID. I think people are, I think harsh economic climates sometimes bring this out in people, but there, I'm seeing a little more honesty now. That just seems to be the general temperature of social media, and like it or not, social media is real people. It's what they're thinking and feeling, and that's, I don't know, that's my read on things, and I could be totally wrong and I could be totally skewed in my, and just based on what I'm consuming, but I don't know.
I was told once that Gen CZ is fixated on efficiency to some degree.
Yeah, I think they're a lot like, they're like an echo of Gen X, and we're an echo of the boomers.
Oh, that's
which doesn't feel good.
I hadn't thought about that,
but
I do think like that idea of efficiency of like, you know, cutting through the BS, so to speak, you know, like,
yeah,
that's kind of what you're hinting at, right?
Yeah.
Like even like somebody said to me once, like, to the degree that Gen Z is socially conscious with things like poverty, climate change, whatnot, it's that they're impatient with solutions that don't yield results, you know,
they're impatient with like hiring consultants to tell you what you should do.
Yeah, exactly, right? They're just kind of like, well, whatever, if it's a technological solution, if it's a whatever, like whatever it is, just do it, right.
Yeah.
stop talking about it, stop telling us why we need to do it, and there's probably some truth to that. Whereas we get to Christian Gen Z, I don't know, like that's, It'll be kind of intriguing to see like what kind of Christianity comes forth from that. I do think like at a certain point there's going to be a real rejection of the reliance on technology, reliance on virtual living.
Yeah, no, totally. I already like see this among people that want to become parents, is a real resistance to like having their kids be discipled or brought up by the internet, be pacified by iPads, you know. I don't think this is just the circles I run. I think genuinely like we've just come out of our teenage years and we know how like destructive a lot of this stuff can be on young forming impressionable minds, and I think a lot of us are afraid of that for our own kids. Like that, I feel that like, I'm having a child in September. So, I guess this is my way of announcing that I'm going to be a parent on the show, but,
I knew this already.
Yeah. Just Andrew, so Andrew didn't know this.
I didn't have to feign shock.
Yeah.
What?
But this is stuff I'm starting to think about too. And of course, I know I'm going to mess up my own kids in some way that I cannot foresee right now. But I don't want to mess them up in the way that I already know that I was a little bit messed up by. I can at least do better than that without, you know, hopefully being too reactionary. Man, this is tough. I don't know.
It certainly is.
I
wonder though, like the idea of not being afraid though is, there's a couple ways you can think about it, I think. I don't know if I said that right. But on the one hand, like you can be wary of, obviously, like you identified the risks, right? But not being afraid of it means like not letting it master you, right? Like not letting, not buying into everything that the world is trying to sell you for you and your child and your family. And right.
Right.
So if you're not afraid of it in that sense, you can take from it what is good and life affirming. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there are TV shows and there are online articles and there are products sold at Walmart that are going to be helpful, I think.
Sure.
To what you want to achieve. And so with confidence, you can adopt those.
Yeah, identify them.
Right?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Like we've not been given a spirit of fear, you know. We've been given the Holy Spirit, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, and I think we have to have a little bit of faith in that to help us identify, like, the wheat from the chaff, so to speak.
Yeah.
We can't just blanket be afraid of everything that comes with some new, you know, technological innovation or way of being, or I don't know, whatever the future brings, right? Like, so I'm trying to take that into parenting also, just in my preparation for the fact that I'm going to raise a child in a world that I am, like, everybody's going to be out of touch at some point, and I'm going to be increasingly out of touch with the world as it changes. And my parents were out of touch to an extent with the world I grew up in, and that's just been the tale of everything from the beginning of time. And to, you know, you kind of mentioned that, like, be not afraid, that being a message for maybe this very moment. But I think that's kind of a message for every generation. Although maybe it feels more heightened right now.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a generation
there is that a lot of fear.
Really needs to hear it. Yeah.
Do you, I'm curious, are your, some of your, nervousness and anxiety, are they more on like the, for lack of a better characterization, are they more on the temporal or more on the, spiritual? So for instance, like, are you thinking about your child in terms of, like, you know, what they're going to learn and how they're going to develop? Are they going to scrape their knee? Are they going to, you know, break their neck or what? Or are you thinking about, like, at this point anyway, about the, you know, passing on of the faith and,
yeah,
and
no, it's definitely the latter category for sure.
Yeah. Really, that's more your preoccupation.
Oh yeah. Way more. Yeah. I think even just like, I was thinking about this the other day, 'cause I've known parents a little older than me. Like, I knew one guy that, like, he had one child and he stopped because he's like, I don't want to bring any more children into, like, the world in this day and age. Mm. And, it's on one level, I get it. Climate change and political uncertainty and, like, growing wealth disparity. And all, there's so many reasons to be pessimistic about the future.
To be fearful.
There are. And yet, I think it is disobedient to God to let those fears stop you from, like, fulfilling the call of a married person, for better or worse, which is to be fruitful and multiply and to have two become one flesh, and for a blessing from the Lord, like, to desire a blessing from the Lord that is children. And I think you have to start to agree with God again that your life is a good thing. Like, that is a place I've had to come to, because there was times in my life I didn't think my life was a good thing. I didn't think I wanted to have kids. I fell for the, like, yeah, this is a terrible time to bring children into the world, but that is to be fixated too much on temporal things. And I think that, you know, one of the great acts of resistance you can do nowadays is to affirm that life is good and that it is worth bringing new life into the world in spite of all the challenges. Because that is, I mean, I think the only way we dig ourselves out of this is, well, one, by turning to God, and two, by partnering with him in what he wants to achieve here, for as long as this life kind of remains. I don't know when Jesus is coming back. I don't know when it ends, but I do think that God still created the world and he created it to be good and he still loves it. And I shouldn't be afraid of sin and death and the devil.
Amen. Amen.
Well, some bright morning when this life Nazareth.